case.
May I please the court?
Hold on. Mr. Michaels on this case? All right.
May I please the court?
Same, hang on a second.
Sorry about that.
Same admonitions apply. But I said before, since you both were here. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Carberry.
Sorry, Justice Bender. May I please the court? Tom Carberry appearing for Mr. Perez. In order for this court to affirm and to buy the Attorney General's arguments, this court has to ignore all the federal case law. That's the only way you can affirm this case. Because the federal case law says you can only have an anonymous jury when two factors come into play. First, the judge must make a finding that the defendant poses a serious danger to the jurors. That didn't happen. There's no such thing here. In our record here, the judge had a written case management order saying that this is how we do it in all of our trials. Doesn't matter who the defendant is. And in this case, it's very serious because Mr. Perez was charged with sexual assault, one of the most serious crimes you can be charged with. And two, the federal case says, once the judge makes this finding of the defendant is dangerous, then the judge must do everything he can to protect the defendant's due process rights, including his right to conduct a meaningful voir dire, and two, his right to presumption of innocence. That didn't happen here either. You also have to ignore the fact that all the federal courts, every one of them, has accepted the fact that there are varying degrees of anonymity. You have the massive anonymity where they keep the names and juror information away from the lawyers, but as the court said in the most recent case, Dinkins.
Carver, you know, you might be able to help us a little. Tell us the fundamental facts that predicates your argument.
The facts
in this case, yes. Well, not the facts of the offense, but the facts with respect to the jury, what the jury knew, the questionnaire, and the objection by the
happened in this case is they had a jury questionnaire. The judge made no explanation to the jurors of any kind. During voir dire,
wait a second, this is a Weld County case, right?
It's a Weld County case.
So the same, most likely the same instruction was given to the jurors were told that the questionnaire goes to all the parties, right?
No, that did not happen in this case. What happened in this case, we had a pretrial motions hearing. And in the motions hearing, the judge told the parties, we're going to have an anonymous jury. We're not going to use the names of the juries. Defense counsel objected and made the perfect objection, said that that might be appropriate in a case for John Gotti, but it's not appropriate for Mr. Perez. Because now the jury's going to think he's a criminal and he's dangerous. And so that was the appropriate objection. Then when it came to actual voir dire, what happened was the parties are referring to the jurors by numbers, and the juror asked the judge a question, and the judge started to respond and said, oh, by the way, we're just going to refer to you by numbers in this case. And that's all the judge said. He didn't add anything to it, didn't try to say that this has nothing to do with Mr. Perez. He just left it open. Now, Justice Hobbs, you...
Well, just a second before you. I'm just reading what I think is a transcript from a part of the voir dire. Mike Pello is saying he doesn't know the names of the jurors.
I'm sorry, who's saying that?
Mike Pello, I think, is the prosecutor. Maybe he's not, but the transcript portion I have is just a little bit of it, and he says, good morning, I'm Mike Pello, I represent the people of Colorado. You now have me at a disadvantage because I don't know any of your names. I'm going to address you by juror number. It seems kind of a rude thing to do, but that's how we do it, so I'm going to call you by number.
Yes.
So is it correct that he doesn't know any of the people's names?
I don't actually know the answer to that, Justice Rice, because they did have a questionnaires, whether they knew the names or not, but the record indicates they didn't. But whether they did or not, I don't think is really the issue. The issue in this case is they referred to by numbers, and the federal case law has all said that is an anonymous jury.
But I really would like to try to drill down on this question of whether they know the names. Now, this is a different district court judge in Greeley who, just looking at the Court of Appeals decision,
yes,
it would seem that way. So Justice Bender, Chief Justice Bender, asked you if they would have used the same questionnaires, if those are the kinds of questionnaires. Do you know the answer to that?
I don't, but it seems to me that Judge Kopkow had his own case management order, that was, it didn't look like it was a, it might have been a district-wide one, but I don't know, and I don't have the records in the other two cases, and I don't.
Okay, I understand that. Do we have the juror questionnaires as part of the record in your case, sir?
I do not remember. I don't have them in electronic format.
Okay.
And everything else I have is in electronic format.
Sure.
And,
so, but here, at least, it's, we don't know, maybe opposing counsel can help us answer the question of whether the names were actually known to counsel.
We don't know.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And the federal courts all say that there are degrees of anonymity. And in the Dinkins case, Justice Hobbs, the court said the term anonymous jury does not have one fixed meaning. And then it went and it said a lesser degree of anonymity may entail disclosing to the parties the names of the veneer members by identifying them only by number in open court. And so, and the prejudice there goes to the presumption of innocence, because we don't know what the jurors' minds is in the jurors' minds. In fact, we have a rule of evidence, 606B, that says we can't even inquire into the jurors' minds.
Well, I'm entirely aware of that case law.
Yeah.
But now you're into the prejudice issue.
Yeah.
And maybe that's where we ought to be on this, because, you know, the constitutional guarantee ultimately is a fair trial.
Well,
and the prosecution has to bear the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Everything else is covered by the instructions. So help me a little bit. Get me over the hump here about my skepticism about whether the federal cases are anything more than the way they want to handle the courtroom, and really don't go to the essence of the constitutional protection.
No, the federal cases all go deeply into the essence of the federal protection. They all call the anonymous jury a drastic remedy.
Which version of the anonymous jury?
All of them, what they look at is what the judge did, because when the judge follows the federal rules, then they apply the abuse of discretion standard. If the judge makes the dangerousness finding and then does something to preserve the presumption of innocence, the courts look at whether the courts did it well enough. And some of the cases, they uphold the conviction. They say, well, these people looked very dangerous, and the judge did a good job of explaining it. And most of the explanations are that we want to protect you from the media. That's sort of become a pretty standard explanation. But a lot of the cases, they reverse. Because they say, you know, these people really weren't, there was no finding of dangerousness. These people weren't that dangerous. There wasn't an adequate explanation. And here we have neither. Here, under either standard, under abuse of discretion standard, definitely the court abused its discretion. Because the court has a duty to know the law. This court held back in 1994 in People Against Ronald White that we presume the judges know the law.
Well, could I interrupt you right there 1 second? We've talked about knowing the law a little bit. Counsel before you said that too. You all make a great deal about the federal cases. I've seen the ones you cite. I didn't have time to go read them. I take it nobody's suggesting the U.S. Supreme Court has commented on this in a way that's definitive for us.
In my opening brief, I pointed out that the U.S. Supreme Court has not addressed this. But in the last 10 years, the U.S. Supreme Court has done a number of seminal Sixth Amendment cases, Crawford, Apprendi, Bullcoming, in Gonzalez-Lopez. And in Bullcoming and Gonzalez-Lopez, they said, once you have the Sixth Amendment violation, no further showing of prejudice is required.
Right. And we're still, I think, I'm still looking at the question about this particular problem and with regard to a Sixth Amendment violation. We have a number of federal courts, of course. The trial court in this case was not bound by what the federal courts do, and neither are we. We might find them to be persuasive, but that depends on the nature of their decision-making and what all it was based on. So I was just concerned a little bit at the suggestion that the courts in these cases have failed to know or follow the law. You're not making the argument that there was any binding precedent on them that they disregarded.
No, but what I am making the argument is that the federal court set the floor for federal constitutional rights, and the states cannot go below the
floor. But not the federal circuit courts, right? We're not, the state courts are not bound by the circuit court's determinations at all.
I agree with you, but when every single federal circuit is off.
And I wanted to ask you that. Is that true? I didn't count them up exactly. You have a number. When you say all federal courts, are you talking about all those federal circuits that have decided this issue?
Exactly. The ones that have decided the issue.
Now, right.
I don't think every single federal court has, but the most recent one is the Fourth Circuit. And they all say, you have to make these two findings. You have to have the finding of dangerousness and then something to allay the prejudice to the defendant. And if the judge does that, then it's fine.
Do any of those cases, though, and I read a big stack of them, I don't recall any of them, and correct me if I'm wrong, that involved a situation quite like this. And though they were true anonymous juries where defense counsel was not permitted access to the names or names plus additional information.
I don't remember any of the cases that they completely withdrew the names from defense counsel, unless it was Barnes, one of the first cases. I think in most cases, most of the cases are numbers jurors. Number cases, not withholding everything from the lawyers. I think most of them are what we call numbers jurors.
So you're saying, you're representing that the federal case law is a situation like this where defense counsel was provided access to the jurors' names, but they were simply required during voir dire to refer to those jurors by number?
Yes, some of them, yes, and then some of them also had the names withheld. But all of those are considered anonymous jurors by the federal courts.
I've seen state court cases along those lines. I'm just not immediately recalling any federal cases. Can you point me to a specific one?
I can't off the top of my head, but when I sit down, I'll look
at it. Okay, thank you.
Counsel, can I just follow up on that? I mean, just wind us back to the Court of Appeals opinion. I mean, the Court of Appeals basically says your cases, the names were withheld from the parties, and they cite this Thomas case. And then the Court of Appeals expressly says the questionnaires here explicitly stated the parties would have access to the answers, and they were told, the jurors were told that. I guess you're just, are you disputing the case law that the Court of Appeals is relying on, or the facts,
no,
or
I'm,
both?
I'm not disputing that. I don't think it matters whether the lawyers knew the names or not. Assuming that they knew the names, they used the numbers. By the use of the numbers with the jurors, that's the violation right there. That violated Mr. Parris's Sixth Amendment rights, and his lawyer objected to it.
Okay. And then just one more question. Then I guess you're disputing the Court of Appeals rationale is that if this information was shared with defense counsel and the jurors knew it was shared with the defense counsel, how could there be a presumption of anything or an inference of anything?
Well, the Court of Appeals actually said this wasn't an anonymous jury at all based on that. That's what they said in Mr. Parris's case. And the federal case law says that's not true. I mean, the latest case, Dinkins, which just came out on August 14th of this year, said that that's one of the forms of anonymous jurors is a numbers jury, where you refer to the jurors by numbers. And what we're talking about is, does the Sixth Amendment mean less in a small town? That's really what's happening here. And Justice Bender, you asked the question, what's the reason? And Mr. Michael said it's contextual. Well, my reason, and I believe I've been doing criminal defense for a long time, is it makes it easier for the jurors to convict people when they know that the defendant doesn't know their names. It makes it easier for white jurors to convict a Hispanic defendant. We don't like to hear that in courts. Nobody likes it. Everybody wants to believe we live in a racially harmonious society, but we don't. And we know that because in Weld County, we had the case Gutierrez just a couple years ago in 2009, where the district attorney went and got tax records from all the Hispanic defendants.
I'm really having trouble with this argument right now because the jury's looking the defendant right in the face. If they have that racial kind of motivation, they're going to have it. It's got to come out somehow in the background of voir dire, et cetera, right? I mean, give me a break.
No, it makes it just as...
I don't understand that. I just explain, wrap that back for me.
Well, I've done dozens and dozens of felony trials.
Okay.
And jurors are human beings. And jurors like to hide information about themselves. They like to, just like all of us, they like to make themselves seem better. And when jurors know that they're free from observation, and the Sixth Amendment, you know, the whole idea of the public trial in the Sixth Amendment is so the public can see what's going on. They can listen to the jurors. They can know.
I understand my question is that they have the information, right? They know who these jurors are.
The public doesn't.
No, I'm not. I thought you were talking about the defendant's Sixth Amendment's rights, not the public's.
Well, the Sixth Amendment guarantees a public trial. It doesn't, you know,
that means the public can come in the courtroom and see the proceedings.
That's right, and to hear the names of the jurors. That's right. To hear the names of the jurors and to know if the jurors are telling the truth. To know if that what's going on. Yes, a public trial means public.
Okay.
Yeah. And I want to correct a serious misstatement that Mr. Michaels made. He said there was no case that held that it was structural error. That's completely not true. State against Hill in Ohio, the Court of Appeals held it was structural error. The Ohio Supreme Court granted certiorari and reversed and saying, well, they didn't preserve the issue, so we won't address it. But one of the justices dissented. Justice Pfeiffer dissented, said, hey, I think this is structural error. We don't know what these jurors were thinking. And that's the essence of structural error. You don't know what the jurors are thinking. Because who knows what went into the mind of the jurors? Mr. Michaels wants to say, well, they might have done something, thought something good about the defendant. But the real issue is, and that's what all the federal case law says, there is the specter that the jurors will think that the defendant is dangerous. And in a rape case like Mr. Perez's, the specter is really large. And
so do I understand you to say the one case that you're saying did find structural error was an intermediate appellate court in a state that got reversed on other grounds?
On another grounds, yes. Well, it got reversed by the Supreme Court saying that the error wasn't preserved, so we're reversing. But the one state Supreme Court that did address this exact issue, and it's so much on point, is the Oregon case of Sundberg. There, the judge tells the lawyers, we're not going to use numbers on these jurors. We're doing it in all the trials. It goes up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court reverses. Says no. You got to find dangerousness, and you got to leave the prejudice to the defendant. You have to do two federal prongs. That's the one state Supreme Court that actually addressed the issue. They reversed. And I asked on behalf of Mr. Perez, this court followed the Oregon Supreme Court and set a rule. You know, this is a public policy issue for the state of Colorado. If Colorado trial judges want to have anonymous juries, they can. But they must make two findings. They must make the finding of dangerousness, and then they must do something by instructions to protect the defendant's rights.
So just to follow up, but what they cannot do, I guess, under your argument, is they could never come up with an administrative policy.
They could never do that.
That is just not possible.
It's not possible under the federal constitution. Thank you very much.
Good morning again. My name is Joseph Michaels, attorney registration number 40403. I'm here today on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I'd like to start off by reading a quote. The case I'm reading from is State versus Hill, the Ohio Supreme Court case that Mr. Carberry just referenced. And this quote appears on towards the end of page 282. We do not believe that the anonymous jury rule impinges on fundamental rights in the same way as the deprivation of counsel in Gideon, or the biased trial judge in Toomey, or the racial discrimination in Vasquez. Accordingly, to the extent that the Court of Appeals held that structural error warrants the reversal of appellee's convictions, we reverse that judgment. I want to address a few other brief things that he said. Justice Rice, you had asked about the prosecution knowing the names and whether you have the...
I was just reading the transcript. That was all.
Sure. You do have those questionnaires, and they do say the exact same thing. All parties in this case have this information.
Why did the prosecutor, Mr. Pello, seem to suggest to the jurors that he didn't know their names?
I think he was just doing a sort of an informal, colloquial, hello, this is who I am, I want to learn a little bit about you. And then I think he went a little above and beyond that and said, I don't mean to be impersonal by referring to you by numbers. And I think he was doing it in a way to suggest that it wasn't to indicate that the defendant was presumed guilty, but rather to say, this is how we're doing it. I don't want you to take offense to it.
Could I ask a question? Did the record reflect, was there something unusual about this case requiring a special prosecutor or a substitution of the offices?
Not that I remember, to be perfectly frank. I don't remember, no. No.
Mr. Pello is a Denver district attorney, right? Or was at the time?
Honestly, no? I just don't know. I wish I did.
Okay. I just wondered if there was anything having to do with some kind of secrecy, gag order, conflict, something like that.
If there was, it's not in the record, at least not that I was able to find.
I don't mean to belabor this point, but he seems to make a very clear point. He says, you have me at a disadvantage because I don't know any of your names, so I'm going to address you by juror number. It seems to me kind of a rude thing to do, but that's how we do it. So I'm going to call you by number. So hopefully you know your number.
I think he was just telling them that's how we're going to discuss it with you. I don't know why he would say that. He definitely has the questionnaires. The questionnaires definitely went to the parties. And the questionnaires are in the record, so you'll be able to see that.
Thank you.
I also want to say that in terms of just rooting it very quickly in this case before we start talking about some of the overarching law, the trial court, this is on page 413 of the record, as you know, it's one long electronic record. The trial court told the jury, it's my practice, we do it to respect your privacy, and that he also told the counsel in chambers that it's in the juror's best interest. Again,
didn't he just tell counsel that? The way I read the transcript and the record is that he had this fairly long conversation with counsel in chambers about that.
He told counsel in chambers that it was for the juror's best interest, but then he told the jurors on page 413 of the record that it's the court's practice and we do it to respect your privacy. So he gave them two reasons, and it's that same quotation that I can't remember who was in the other side, other part of the argument said, and by the way, I wanted to say before juror so-and-so you talk, our policy here is to refer to you by number. So it was told to the jurors.
But where do we have it in the record where the judge said it? I mean, I have the judge talking. I can find transcript of the judge talking at some length in chambers to the lawyers when Mr. Shepard, who I guess is the defense attorney, is making his objection, the John Gotti objection.
But that's on page 377.
Right, I have it in front of me.
Go to page 413.
Okay, I guess I don't have that, but I'm sorry. Wasn't downloaded for me, but 413 is where I ought to be looking.
413 is.
And do you have it in front of you? Could you read to me? And
we can
look at it.
I don't have.
But it's your representation that the judge said something to the jury
The judge says something directly to the jury as he is addressing. He actually interrupts addressing one specific juror to address the entire veneer before he goes back to addressing.
Thank you.
You're right. He talks about it being a cleaner record.
Right.
Rather than using your seat number rather than your surname.
Right, and it says for practice.
106 stuff.
Well, what about this privacy concern? I mean, is that the... Let's just assume they have that policy in the courtroom where it's an individual policy. What privacy is talked about? Is that the press reporting the juror's name? Is it the people in the courtroom may link it up and that's an invasion of privacy? I mean, what...
Based on what the other statements in the other cases are, it's mostly about the media, but they don't go into an extended discussion of it's for the privacy. The judge here talks about how he's had previous jurors mention that they appreciate the privacy, they appreciate not having their names said in open court, and so I assume it's for publicity's sake, but there's no specific record of saying it's for the media, unlike in Robles when they do talk about...
So Michael, can I ask you a little different kind of question for a minute?
Sure.
I see you're on all three of these cases. Is there any information other than the questionnaire that's going to all parties that's told to the jurors about whether their names or anything is being withheld? Do they know that specifically or not specifically?
No.
In any of these cases?
In no case are they told your names are being withheld from the parties.
Are they told the other thing?
In every case, they are told your names and information are going to the parties.
By what process?
By the questionnaire.
By the questionnaire. Anything else other than that?
No, they don't say anything about it one way or another. And to me, that's just not a way of not drawing attention to it beyond.
In other words, it's all throughout the questionnaire, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's all throughout.
And typically, these questionnaires are filled out by the jurors like the day before or the morning before the actual voir dire. Is that right?
I would guess so, although in each one of these cases, every one of them, in Robles, in Perez, and again later in Rizzo, they had extended very case-specific questionnaires. So in addition to the very basic name, address, workplace, they had very case-specific questionnaires.
But when are they filled out? I guess that's my question.
There's no evidence in the record of it, but I mean, I would think the very basic questionnaire, and there are...
There's two sorts of things, and the questionnaire you're talking about, the one that informs them is tailored to that case.
Right.
So what I want to know is the timing of when they're on, when they get in the box.
It would be that morning.
That day.
Okay. That day. I also wanted to speak briefly before I discuss prejudice a little bit. As far as I can tell, all the federal court cases, and again, they're not binding so much as a guide for this court, none of them deals with a numbers-only situation like here. In every one of the court of appeals, federal court cases, they deal with some amount of that information is actively withheld, which means that...
Excuse me, by that you're talking about withheld from the jurors, right?
Sorry, from
the jurors or from the defense counsel?
From the defense counsel.
Okay.
In every one of those situations, whether it's an address, a last name, a work address, some combination thereof, information is actively withheld from them. And that becomes a very different issue than here, where you're just referring to them by numbers, but all the information is given to the defendant, and the jury knows that the parties have their information. The reason that's different is because that impacts the ability for a defendant to conduct a voir dire. And that's one of the key elements that every court looks to. No matter what test they put in, they want to look at, is the defendant allowed to have a meaningful voir dire? And that's one of the things that the Court of Appeals in every one of these cases also saw. They had an extended voir dire. They had extra questionnaires. There was no information withheld. If you look through the voir dire, you see that they're asking very pointed, very intelligent questions about the juror's background. We're not hiding anything. There's no hidden info in here. It's just a question of how effective can the voir dire be? Does the policy impact the defendant's ability to conduct voir dire? If no, then where is the prejudice?
Tell me, since we're talking about, you know, local communities and how these matters are handled, this issue that defense counsel raised about racial bias in a particular community, how do attorneys who want a jury that is a constitutional jury, I'm going to use that in quote, how do they in this state address those kinds of issues?
I think I want to start off by saying that this is not applied just to Hispanic defendants. I cite I can't remember which brief now, there have been at least two that are clearly white defendants that have had this used against them. It's not a matter of saying, we have a defendant of a different race or a different gender or a different anything. It's used uniformly. There's no equal protection violation. Because they're not singling people out specifically based on race.
So I thought I understood the equal protection argument to be that it's Weld County versus defendants in other counties, regardless of race. I mean, meaning Hispanic defendants, African American defendants, white defendants in other counties. So the comparisons between Weld County and the rest of the state.
Well,
as opposed to...
Other trial courts I know also use this, and none of those cases are in front of this court at this moment. Legal protection, it's not...
Am I misunderstanding the equal protection argument?
I think that argument is there, but I don't think it's a strongly developed one. I think the one that opposing counsel has really zeroed in on is this defendant is Hispanic, therefore his equal protection rights have been violated because he's Hispanic, and because this procedure is fundamentally unfair to Hispanic defendants. The other part of it is, it is used in other parts of the states. I know Denver courts have used it. I know a few other counties have used it. I don't want to start naming counties because that's outside of the record, and not strictly in front of this court. It's not singling out defendants differently, and it's not, again, it's just not a different prejudicial process. They're still allowed the exact same voir dire as everything else. They're just using a different method of impaneling. And that method of impaneling is exactly what we talk about when we're talking about abuse of discretion. How does the court, how does or even a court system run its method of voir dire? As long as it doesn't negatively impact the defendant, where's the prejudice? Does that answer your
question? Yeah, and recognizing that this may be well outside the record, is your impression that where it's being used in other counties, it's being used similarly as in Weld, meaning it's used in all cases, or it's for very specific cases?
I don't know that. Fair enough. Just from conversations with different DAs, I know that they've encountered it outside of Weld County, but I don't know how they're used or if they're used universally. I think I've just started going down the abuse of discretion standard. I think I'll just clean up on that a little bit. This is a matter of how a court conducts voir dire. That's something that this court has held repeatedly as within the discretion of the trial court from Lefebvre pretty much on. Discretion is the decision to use numbers at all. It can, the court could not. Discretion is, do you use additional questionnaires? You can, you cannot. Do you allow extra time? You can, you cannot. Even as policy, and one of the state court's decisions that says abuse of discretion applies under all circumstances with this number, innominate, anonymous, administrative, whatever jury we want to end up calling this, even if it's done as a routine policy, that still is under the abuse of discretion standard and not structural error. That case is the Wisconsin case, People versus Tucker, which did the numbers only the numbers only jurors and said that there wasn't reversible error. All the federal courts say it. Every one of them, it says that a trial court has substantial discretion. And unless there are any questions about that, I'd like to talk a little bit more about prejudice, or if there are any questions before I move over to that. Numerous courts, and both federal and state courts, federal, one of them being the Talley Court in the Sixth Circuit, has said that just saying media as an explanation is enough to explain any notion of prejudice. An explanation from a court can help, but it's not required. Even the absence of instruction does not infringe defendant's rights, and that's from Euphrasio and Vario, that's second and third district, second and third courts of appeals. The courts of appeals, the federal courts of appeals that have handled it are second, third, fourth now. I haven't had a chance to read the fourth district case, but it seems that it doesn't add a whole lot. It just says this is an anonymous jury. I don't know if it was a true anonymous jury or an administrative jury. They all say that it's not an automatic reversible error. They all say it's not structural error. What they do is they look at what prejudice the defendant could have suffered, if any, and the cases that reverse, look at cases and see how egregious it is. The Massachusetts case that looked at how egregious the conduct was, the two of the big cases that have reversed, the state court cases, are where the jurors found out in the middle of the trial, out of nowhere, that they were an anonymous jury, and either there was no instruction from the court, in which case they all, if in the absence of instruction, they would be able to speculate endlessly about what it was. And a lot of times, in those two cases, they found out that it was because there had been a threat from the defendant, or the defendant had some sort of potential tie to be able to influence them. And in one case, I can't remember now if it's, I think it's the Massachusetts case, the trial court explicitly told the jurors, we're going to have you be an anonymous jury because the defendant's a dangerous fellow. At that point, yeah, there is a problem. But that's not the case here.
But looking at some of the federal cases, they all do start their analysis. I have no disagreement with you about the abuse of discretion standard with that two-pronged approach before they get into the actual case.
Sure.
And most of the federal cases, at least that I've read, are cases where there's pretty strong reasons or need to deal with it. Organized crime, threats, you know, improper influence, so forth, that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So why shouldn't we adopt that sort of standard anyway with us? What's wrong with that?
I have two responses to that, and please remind me to get back to the second one if I somehow get derailed on the first.
Oh, you have a chance in the next argument.
That's true. The first response is, in all the federal cases that apply that two-prong standard, there's information actively withheld.
From
the defendant. So the analysis starts off with, the analysis becomes an actual anonymous jury situation where you have some degree of information not in front of them that they then have to compromise for. So there has to be more of a finding. Now, there are quite a few courts that say the absence of these findings is not reversible error. And then what they look for is they look at, well, does the jury need protection? So this is me getting back to the second part of this question. Does the jury need protection? And if so, why? And they look at those factors that we've talked about already this morning, involvement in a criminal enterprise, capacity to harm the jury or the court, past interference with the court, the degree of the sentence, the severity of the crime, and how much publicity is involved. And those are all factors that can be considered, but they're not an exhaustive list. And several cases have just said just one of those factors is enough, depending on the situation. Then they also look at, well, what precautions, you know, what precautions has the trial court taken?
So wait a second.
Sure.
Your argument, maybe this is wrong, but it sounds like to me you're saying that we shouldn't get into this two-part test unless something is specifically withheld from either the defendant or the jurors themselves.
That's absolutely right.
The argument?
That
we don't get into this at all?
I don't think this two-prong test applies unless it's something's truly withheld, which we don't have.
From some party.
From some party.
In the Massachusetts case, they also withheld it from the jurors. Jurors, by statute, are required to know in a first degree, in a capital case, they were required by statute.
To let the individuals.
That's right.
Right.
So we don't. So how do we look at this? How do you want us to look at this? You on behalf of the state.
How I want you to look at it is this.
Let me give you an example.
Oh, sure.
Burglary case, first offense, happens in Greeley.
Sure.
There's no need for a questionnaire.
Sure.
And the judge says, cleaner record.
Mm-hmm.
What test do we? How do we look at that?
I think you've essentially articulated what needs to be looked at, which is, jury, we're going to refer to you by number because it makes for a cleaner record. It's this court's policy.
That's okay with you.
I think that's okay because
you don't get into to why we're now doing this. Explanation other than cleaner record.
Well, I don't think you need to say, you don't want to tell the jurors, we're now doing this. I just, it's a policy issue. You know, this makes for a cleaner record. It's administratively convenient. You can tell them that it's privacy related. You know, anything that is said, the more neutral, the better. And you don't want to reflect on whether or not the defendant is.
This is okay throughout the whole state, right? As a policy, it's okay to do this kind of thing.
I don't think it's significantly different than than how we conduct voir dire already, except for instead of names, we have numbers, because these jury lists are still available to the public. You can still find out from the names of a master jury wheel, or maybe that's not accurate. I don't know. So,
does your position depend on its adoption, a widespread policy adoption? I mean, what if only one or two judges in Weld only occasionally use this, but, you know, they have a particular court reporter who prefers this practice, or a particular judge thinks that, you know, I'm going to protect my jurors' privacy, and therefore I'm going to choose to use it in this particular case. How dependent is it on it being uniform?
I don't think it's dependent on being uniform, because that's part of the discretion of conducting voir dire. I think if you have that neutral explanation, and I do think an explanation, especially going forward, would be good. I don't think any of these cases requires, with the absence of an explanation or a less detailed explanation, requires a reversal at this point. But going forward, I think a very neutral explanation should be given, because we want to uphold any sort of negativity, that any sort of negative presumption that may or may not occur.
So the message is, if you're going to do it, you should give an explanation, but we're not going to find a reversible error if you don't.
Well, certainly not in these cases, when there was no law governing it at this point. I guess I don't know how you would handle the absence of an explanation. At that point, there's law on the books. The trial courts are explicitly aware of the law in Colorado saying, this is how we do it. You have to give an explanation. In the absence of an explanation, then it's probably...
And what?
But again...
How do you review for that? I mean, how do you assess the prejudice in that context, then? No explanation.
I think that's... Let me finish here. Chief Justice, do you mind if I respond? I think that's the big conundrum with this issue, is it's just not an error. We have all the information given to all the parties. All the trial is open to all the public. There's no presumption of dangerousness. There's no presumption of prejudice. You just have brought here that you have numbers instead of names.
So your position is simply, it's not error to begin with, period. There's no reason to assess prejudice on the back end, because it's not error.
That's right.
From the beginning.
Here's what I'm concerned about, is even with what you suggested, and we've been down this route many times, I think, in the court's history. Let's take the Curtis advisement. So you get a nice procedural rule, we put an opinion, right? Because we think that's the way it ought to happen, mm-hmm. better. And then, of course, we have a whole bunch of convictions based on the actual wording has not been given. These procedural things that we seem to establish sometimes in case law then launch onto themselves, and they become all of a sudden of some kind of a reversible dimension. So would you please, if the Chief Justice will allow, comment on that issue about whether or not we really need to...
Can we say that, answer that question, because this gentleman is going to be arguing the next case as well.
That's fine. I'm willing to hold it back, but I'm concerned now about these procedural kinds of things that we're asked to put in opinions, and they're reverberations.
So please keep in mind Justice Hobbs' question.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Thank you.
When you render your verdict.
We'd like to go to the... I'd like to go to the next case.
Do you still have a rebuttal?
Mr. Carver has...
Oh, I'm sorry. I apologize, Mr. Carver. I forgot you had 4 minutes. 1 minute and 31 seconds. I'm really sorry.
About a minute of it at the most.
Well, that's...
I would like... Before you really get into your stuff, and I won't take much time, but you seem to know, and I don't want to take you outside the record, but can you explain what this deal was with Pello?
It's not Mike Pello.
Okay.
I think
okay.
It's not Mike Pello.
Okay.
He's... In private practice.
Okay. Now.
Yeah, but he was a Denver DA. In fact, I seem to remember that DA's name was Wilkinson, but, you know, I might be, you know, my memory might not be all there, okay? I want to talk about the prejudice to Mr. Perez. This case, the facts of this case are very close. Mr. Perez testified in this case that they were drinking, he and his girlfriend and the victim in this case, and that the victim engaged in consensual sex with him. The victim testified the opposite. That was it. There was no forensic evidence. And Mr. Perez's lawyer objected to this procedure. I think the only way you even get to the question of whether the judge abused discretion or not is, did the judge meet either of these tests? And since he didn't, I don't think you can apply the abuse of discretion, because the judge didn't exercise any discretion at all. In this particular case, he just had a rule saying we're doing it in all cases. That's not discretion. That's just a broad brush approach to the law.
Mr. Carby, let me ask you the question that I think that Mr. Michaels was arguing, which is that all of the federal, the two-prong test that we've heard a lot about is not actually triggered until there's something withheld from somebody, particularly the defense counsel.
I don't think that's true, and I don't have the cases off the top of my head, but the Dinkins case that came out on August 4th cites to the district federal district court case that Mr. Hostetler cited to. And that case really goes through all the cases, and as the court in Dinkins says, there's a continuum of anonymity. And in this case, we have one version of it, which the courts have called the numbers jury. And in this case, Mr. Perez got 24 years to life in prison. 24 years to life in prison, and his Sixth Amendment rights were violated. And for that reason, I'd ask this court to vacate Mr. Perez's conviction and to remand for a new trial. Thank you.
And so last, our trilogy here. Do you want to take a break? I'm advised that the court would like to take a break, so. But I don't want Mr. Michaels to forget that answer.
Yeah, that's because I'm surprised what my question was.
So both cases, I thank both counsel. I should have, on both cases. We've heard all the counsel for your arguments and your briefs. Those cases will be submitted on the briefs, and Justice Boatwright will participate.